Okay, name, sell, and brand sell. So if they can take a hit from another country and then shine it up and make it American, they think they've got a better chance. Which means that we are not getting the films that we want to see. And I don't know how it's going to change, but some of the studios are probably going to have to fold. There's just too many.
Karen Krasanovich on the curious case of Paramount's financial woes. Have we reached peak reboot and remake? We'll find out today on The Cinema Show. Also ahead.
I have to say it was a surprise. I didn't know entirely where Sally was going with it, and it is Sally's film. I was quite impressed at the way she was able to link elements of my life with the films.
A lesson on film criticism from the Australian legend, David Stratton. And a little later.
Woody Wilson was a hopeless romantic, a whimsical dreamer who became a hero not because of mutation or alien origins or even a $1 billion inheritance that allowed him to build marvellous gadgets. He became a hero because he dreamed of being a hero.
One of the rare superheroes of the screen who wasn't part of a tentpole franchise. Alas, he also proved to be very unpopular. We'll revisit the brief career of Condor Man. That's all to come on The Cinema Show on Monocle 24.
For all the successes of movies and television shows, the entertainment business is in many ways facing the best of times and the worst of times. And what I mean by that is this amazing pace of technology and innovation is allowing us to make more exciting creative content than ever before and to deliver it in more ways than anyone has ever experienced.
That's Jim Giannopoulos speaking at a Greek America Foundation event some years ago. Earlier this week, it was announced that he would be taking over as the new chairman and CEO of Paramount Pictures, ending 12 years at the top for his predecessor, Brad Grey.
When I got there, they were at a place where they didn't have much development. There really wasn't much product. And so we had to pretty much start from scratch. We had to take a look at the business and really understand what was coming. Really look at where the business would be. Was it to be an international business? Was it to be a business clearly that had to move toward the next distribution front in terms of digital? Where were we? And then how do we tell great stories? How do we tell entertaining stories? How do we try to make this a great chapter so that when I look back at this period of my life or this period of Paramount, I can at least look back and say, oh yeah, they did some great work at that time.
But why was Paramount on the hunt for a new CEO? Well, that's where our story today begins. This is The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. I'm Ben Rylan. Earlier in the week, box office returns in the US hit an all-time high for the month of March, skyrocketing to over $1 billion. But not all the Hollywood studios are cracking open the champagne. Last year, Paramount Pictures lost $450 million, largely thanks to the poor performance of films such as Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Zoolander 2, and the spectacular disaster that was the remake of Ben-Hur.
How long were you a slave?
5 years.
What is your name?
Ben-Hur.
Since the fall of MGM's Louis B. Mayer, studio heads haven't lasted very long in the face of consecutive box office flops. But Paramount isn't the only studio resting all too heavily on the tried and tested formula of remakes and reboots. So why can Disney remake and reboot themselves to the tune of $14 billion, while Paramount loses $450 million? Critic and commentator Karen Krasanovich says, in the big studio world, the old mantra, you're only as good as your last job, proves all too true.
Paramount has made some bad decisions. We've all made bad decisions. But Paramount has actually, I mean, it should be lauded for taking risks.
I don't know if you can call them risks, because it does seem as though the main reasons that Paramount has done badly is because the movies that they didn't take risks upon did badly, whereas the movies that other studios didn't take risks upon did quite well. I mean, Disney's not taking any risks at the moment. They've bought Marvel and they're pumping out all of their old classics in new live-action versions. And sure, we all want to race out and see The Jungle Book and Beauty and the Beast. Many of us probably have already done last weekend. But it's not a risk. It's a movie that they know everyone's going to want to see. Paramount have tried to do the same thing, and yet nobody wants to see their low-risk attempts.
Well, when I said that they were taking risks, they're actually doing, I suppose, conversely, they're pumping out a lot of sequels and remakes without any real, with one exception, I suppose, Monster Trucks, without any real original content. I mean, they're really, really relying on a lot of repeats. But I think also that there's been a leadership issue within Paramount. And I think that some productions have lost their way, gotten lost. I mean, for example, Monster Trucks, if we're going to take that on, it's a bit unfair because it is such a diabolical production, was based on an idea the man had about his three-year-old son, was appealing to six-year-old audience. Parents weren't wanting to go see it, was marketed badly, and then had a long delay. And anytime there's a long delay, consumers who are any vaguely interested will find this out. And the critics didn't like it either. So in a way, their one attempt at making something fresh and risky really failed, really tanked. There's no safety net at Paramount. I think that's one of the problems.
Are we starting to see, whatever the climate of movies is, however you could describe the current climate for movies, are we starting to see it sort of get chipped away? Because any of us who know about movie history will know that what we're seeing right now, even though the media at the moment is completely different to how it's always been in the past, you know, it's flooded. There are so many different people making movies. There's so many different ways to watch movies. TV and movies are often considered the same thing in many people's minds. And then streaming is a whole different story. But if we look back at maybe the 1940s or the 1930s even, it's not that different because you had many of the same studios were still the most powerful studios in the world. The king of them all was MGM, and yet after a little while, come the late 1950s, they could not create a movie that was a hit anymore. The old classic MGM-style wholesome production was completely out of fashion, and Louis B. Mayer, the king of Hollywood, didn't know what to do, and eventually his head rolled and the whole studio system went with it. Are we starting to see that sort of thing happen all over again?
Well, Hollywood has often been accused of being slow-moving, that it can't react as well to trends or as to changes in technology. And I think that that is true to a certain extent. It is sort of a decision by committee. I think in the 20s and 30s, I mean, obviously it was a very, very different. I mean, movies were events. You saw them in the theater and then you couldn't see them anywhere else.
But they still try to follow that formula, don't they? They try to make movies into events, even if it doesn't always work.
And Disney does a good job of it. But Disney, let's take Beauty and the Beast, for example. They got the best writers, the best designers, the best music. Well, Beauty and the Beast had great music attached to it anyway, but three new songs. You know, Bill Condon, a terrific writer and a very, very experienced director. And really pitched with diversity and knowledgeable, I mean, a great cast that everybody knows. So they really invested in something that they knew already had a huge fan base. I mean, not only with the previous animated versions, but also with the Broadway musical. And in a way, it's almost like Les Mis, you know, with huge, huge fan base already. So they're chipping away at the risk. But I think what's happening now is that the studios are running scared. They're trying to make good decisions in a really difficult climate. And I think Netflix is kind of, well, genuinely cutting the legs out from under them.
Are we being a little bit harsh when we say, oh, studios, they never like to take risks? I mean, we've said that since the dawn of time. I know you and I, when we sat down here today, we immediately said, haven't people been complaining about remakes since the dawn of time? I recall back in the late 90s, people hated remakes because someone had just remade The Haunting.
Yes.
And then eventually after that came a whole string of horror movie remakes, House on Haunted Hill, etc. They kept on coming. And they haven't stopped. And that's because since the early 1900s, since the dawn of film, we've been remaking stuff over and over again. But you know, studios have never wanted to take risks. What kind of business model goes out there and says, we want to take a risk, we want to risk our existence just because? You know, we know what can happen when movie studios take a risk and it doesn't pay off because United Artists doesn't exist anymore because of one film that didn't do well. Mm-hmm. Are we being too harsh?
Well, I think we are. We're not really understanding. We're looking at it as consumers. And I go to the movies as much as I can, although recently I have to say I've been skipping some screenings myself because I'm just not enthralled. You know, I get a choice. But when I talk to other people, they say, well, you know, I might go to the cinema once a year, twice a year. And I'm thinking, wow, what do you do? You know, they sit home and watch television. Netflix, I suppose. We aren't understanding what it's like from the business side. I mean, nobody starts up a business going, I've got this thing I want to do and maybe somebody will buy it. No. You can't do that. I mean, maybe on a small scale you can. But the movie industry started off because people wanted to see these things. And so they built on that. I mean, the second 1916, as we were talking, that the fall of a nation was a sequel to birth of the nation. And they did that because people wanted to see the first one. And so they figured they wanted to see more. So the fact that Hollywood is trying to be risk-averse is basically they're trying to stay in business. And they're trying to stay in business long enough so that they can give us what they think we want. Now, the old adage is give the audience what they want, but in the way they least expect it. It's the second part that's really difficult. And Disney's Beauty and the Beast got that right. And Monster Trucks got that wrong.
Let's look at the numbers then. Back in 2007, Transformers cost the studio $150 million to produce and brought in a whopping $700 million. In 2009, J.J. Abrams' reboot of Star Trek cost a similar amount but only managed $385 million. Not a failure, but not an astronomical sum either. Last year's installment of the franchise, Star Trek Beyond, cost $185 million, but again, takings struggled to surpass $350 million. It's a far cry from 2011 when Paramount was celebrating its place on top of Hollywood with $5 billion of box office. Of course, as was proven by perhaps Paramount's greatest ever star, the nature of movie making is highly cyclical. The box office wins can change very quickly.
I am big. It's the pictures that got small.
I knew there was something.
Who decides what movies we like and which ones flicker and die? We might like to think it's all down to personal taste, but studio marketing teams, public relations firms, and of course film critics would likely beg to differ. Those who make movies and those who review them often have a, well, shall we say, difficult relationship. But a new production out of Australia puts a new spin on all of that by pointing the camera right back at one of the nation's most admired critical voices, David Stratton. James Viver ventured out to a cinema in the nation's capital, Canberra, to watch David Stratton, A Cinematic Life, and ask him what it really means to watch movies well.
He speaks his own truth. If he likes it, he likes it. If he doesn't like it, he doesn't like it. And what's very cool, though, is I have known him to change his mind.
That feeling that David has brought to us all as Australian filmmakers, that we're doing something that's worth recording.
Actors Russell Crowe and Jack Thompson paying tribute to Australia's best-known film critic, David Stratton. David was a feature on Australian TV for more than 30 years, on the national broadcasters SBS and the ABC, on the well-known show At the Movies. David and his co-host, the equally revered and equally loved Margaret Pomerantz, were known as much for their on-screen banter as they were for their well-informed reviews, as beautifully illustrated in this exchange from the documentary.
I'd like to point out that you were the one that was dressed at the ABC by someone else. I dress myself.
But I've dressed myself today.
Yes. I can tell.
Shut up.
David Stratton, then, is something of a national treasure in Australia, but he's also known in the industry as a walking encyclopedia of movie knowledge. He's seen more than 26,000 films, not including those he's seen more than once, and he's catalogued every single one of them.
Well, I honestly started my filing system when I was about 12 years old, because by that time I'd already, for some time before that, started writing notes about all the films I saw, because this was a sort of childhood hobby. It was really other kids collected stamps and things like that, and I just collected these notes on movies, and I had scrapbooks of ads which I cut from the paper or photographs I'd taken of from films and so on. And I started the filing system, first of all, just with just directors and the films they made and links to their reviews of those films. And I've just kept it going.
How often do you use it?
Every day. It hasn't changed at all since I was 12. It's still there, just the same.
My recollection of my brother David was he wanted to see every film, every single one, in any language. And he would always write a critique of it when he got home.
That's David's brother, Roger. A Cinematic Life tells the story of David's obsessive love affair with the big screen, from childhood to the present day. And told, of course, through the medium he loves. And for once, he could be immersed in the filmmaking process. I asked him just how much he was involved in all the production.
In the pre-production, quite a lot, because the director was a New Zealander who was not very familiar with Australian films, so we had long discussions, and she went away and saw just about every Australian film ever made, I think. And then, of course, during shooting, I was there doing the interviews or being there on the locations where some of the great Australian films were made. I mean, I'm used to being on television, but being out on location and being filmed with a camera, with a dolly, and, you know, all the trappings of a real movie, because it was shot widescreen and all those sorts of things. That was a slightly different situation.
He's got a knife.
That's not a knife. That's a knife.
The documentary is a hybrid of sorts, partly about David, but it also tells the story of Australian cinema itself.
It's me, Miriam.
You're terrible, Miriam.
Well-known scenes of Aussie films are used to tell the story in tandem.
My name is Max. My world is fire and blood.
Seeing it for the first time was, I have to say, it was a surprise, because I wasn't part of the editing process. I didn't know entirely where Sally was going with it, and it is Sally's film. And I was quite impressed and surprised at the way she was able to link elements of my life with the films. And it made me realize for the first time, maybe the reason I like Careful He Might Hear You, for example, is because it has so many connections, which I'd never really thought of, with my own story. And that was a revelation for me. I learned something from watching this film.
Will there be a sequel to A Cinematic Life?
I can't imagine, no, there'll be a sequel. I mean, I'm just amazed that so many people came last night to see it in Canberra at its very first screening. I can't imagine there's going to be an audience for this, but hopefully, for the distributor's sake and the producer's sake, I hope some people will come and see it.
Australian film critic David Stratton there, speaking to James Viver in Canberra. This is The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. Still to come, if you're sick of superhero reboots, well, we'll pen a letter of appreciation to an original high-flying cinematic hero who, sadly, never found much of an audience. Stay tuned. Every few years, someone in the entertainment press throws their arms up in the air in frustrated desperation at the sheer volume of movies being remade. But, of course, the old what's old is only old until its new trick is almost as old as the old hills of Hollywood. Let's consider this classic.
But just try to stay out of my way. Just try. I'll get you, my pretty, and your little dog, too.
The Wizard of Oz is probably the most widely seen film in Hollywood's history, but of course it was indeed a remake, sort of. L. Frank Baum's book had already been turned into several short silent films, but the first feature actually came in 1925, though the plot took such bizarre detours it's really barely worth mentioning.
Say hello to my little friend!
The 1983 version of Scarface is a masterpiece of the gangster genre. It too was, of course, a remake of a 1932 film starring Paul Muni. It's hard to tell when Hollywood's love affair with remakes really hit a peak, but it does seem as though old Hollywood enjoyed familiar territory at least as much as we do today. The first talking picture, The Jazz Singer, made by Warner Brothers in 1927, was remade in 1952 and again in 1980. The most famous version of A Star Is Born stars Judy Garland and was made in 1954. The original version starred Janet Gaynor and was released in 1937, which itself was a recrafted version of an even earlier film, 1932's What Price Hollywood. Even the George Cukor film Holiday, starring Katharine Hepburn that we spoke about last week, was actually a remake of another film of the same name from just 8 years earlier. One place that's rather immune to the plight of repetition, however, is MUBI, the curated movie site of cult, classic, and award-winning films. Each day, one new film is added for 30 days. Right now, in the UK, you can catch Juliette Binoche in 2013's A Thousand Times Goodnight, a drama about the complexities a war-zoned photojournalist faces in her relationship with her family. US subscribers can catch director Volker Schlöndorff's 1985 adaptation of Arthur Miller's classic play, Death of a Salesman, starring Dustin Hoffman. Sample a whole month of movies for free right now. Just head to mubi.com/monocle. That's MUBI/monocle. This is The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. I'm Ben Rylan, and we interrupt our regular programming today for a special word from Condor Man.
Who can save Princess Juliet, held captive by the evil Count Lorca? Who can save the city? Who?
That's from the 1981 film Condor Man, a curious disaster of a movie that Disney produced, perhaps as a sort of answer to the lukewarm popularity of superhero television series of the 1970s, such as Shazam and Wonder Woman. The Spider-Man franchise is about to receive its third reboot since 2002. Clearly, there's really no limit at all to how many times a superhero can swoop across the screen and how many people can indeed play him. But while poor old Condor Man might not have quite as many fans as his modern super friends, the strange audacity of his mere existence is not entirely without appreciation.
Dear Condor Man, I'm writing to simply say I'm sorry. I'm sorry you never got your due, your just desserts as one of cinema's greatest superheroes. You were just ahead of your time, really. Back when you burst onto our screens, all flapping wings and naive amateurism, the only big screen superhero people we were used to was Superman, and nobody wanted to accept a sub-super costume crime fighter. They cruelly turned their backs on you, Condor Man, and your legend died in the early 80s, not so much unloved as just unnoticed. But there was one boy who noticed, one tiny Australian boy, whose parents took him to the drive-in to see you in a double feature with Snow White. She was a superhero herself in a way, although her only real superpower was the ability to endear herself to dwarves. But that night she made barely any impression on me at all. That night I was all about Condor Man. The superhero who wasn't a superhero. The secret agent who wasn't a secret agent. Woodrow Wilson, world famous comic book artist who refused to write any stunt or daring exploit for his characters unless he could prove it would work in real life. Who then got himself caught up in the defection of a beautiful Soviet agent who fell in love with him because she thought he was a crack spy and fell in love with him even more when she found out he wasn't. Woody Wilson was a hopeless romantic, a whimsical dreamer who became a hero not because of mutation or alien origins or even a billion-dollar inheritance that allowed him to build marvellous gadgets. He became a hero because he dreamed of being a hero. And when the chance came along, he kept dreaming big. And so he became Condor Man with his marvellous wingsuit and his brilliant machine gun cane and his beyond awesome gypsy truck that turned into an armoured race car that turned into a hovercraft. Little boy Ben had never seen anything more thrilling than the sequence when Condor Man did battle on the winding mountain roads of Eastern Europe with the evil precision drivers of Oliver Reed's KGB. Beating them with tail-mounted cannons, flamethrowers, a hood ramp, and finally that incredible transformation into a boat to flee the scene. It was your most exhilarating escapade in a relentless barrage of exhilarating escapades. brawls with thugs in Istanbul, motorized flying foxes across the Alps, deadly hillside battles in Yugoslavia, and of course the final showdown, Condor Man spreading his mighty wings to soar over Monte Carlo before destroying the evil Krokov with his laser cannon-equipped speedboat. It wasn't just that you were awesome. You was awesome accidentally. You won fights, even though you didn't know how to fight. You sprayed gunfire at the Russian spooks without having any idea how to operate your gun. You weren't a trained CIA operative. You were just an artist who stumbled into greatness. And if you could do it, why couldn't I? When I was little, growing up to be a famous comic book writer was about as far-fetched an idea as I could imagine. Leaping from comic book writer to international man of mystery wasn't so ridiculous a leap. If Frank Spencer could be a Hollywood action hero, then Ben Pobchi could be anything. Condor Man spoke to me. It's possible I was the only one you spoke to. Too many people refused to listen to the Condor Man message, focusing on petty irrelevancies like whether the movie was good or not. Was it well written? Was it well directed? Were the special effects competent? Was Oliver Reed sober for even one day while shooting? Who cares is my response to all these questions. Condor Man transcends notions of cinematic goodness or badness because he is the superhero in all of us. But the Condor Man story stopped dead. The final shot of the movie set up a sequel perfectly, but no sequel was forthcoming. More fashionable superheroes came along to make the comic book movie commercially viable, and everyone forgot about the most comic booky of comic book movies. I still hold out hope for a reboot, even if Michael Keaton's Birdman means anyone trying to revive Condor Man runs the risk of some very lazy criticism coming their way. I still hold out hope because that's what you taught me, Condor Man. You taught me a comic book geek could get the girl and defeat the evil tyrant. You taught me nothing was impossible for a man with a dream and a passion and a friend who's a filing clerk for the CIA who can get him embroiled in international espionage and through a series of unlikely events eventually end up gaining him access to the agency's R&D department with an unlimited budget. Nothing at all. You taught me that the greatest heroes of all are the accidental ones, and I'll never stop loving you for it.
A letter to Condor Man there, written by Ben Pobchi and read by Barney Burnham.
I remember when I was a little girl, our house caught on fire. I'll never forget the look on my father's face as he gathered me up in his arms and raced to the burning building out on the pavement.
And that's all we have time for on today's show. Next week, do tune in. I'll be sitting down with the director, Raoul Peck, to discuss his sensational Oscar-nominated documentary, I Am Not Your Negro.
At the start of the project, I gave myself a certain number of rules because the idea was, how do I bring Baldwin back to a younger audience?
Today's show was mixed and edited by Kieran Matthew Banerjee and researched by Yolene Goffan. Don't forget to subscribe to the show wherever you get your audio, and we'll leave you now with the sounds of Peggy Lee, who indeed was rather fond of covering a song or two, but loved originality just as much as anyone. This is That All There Is? The Cinema Show is back next week. I'm Ben Rylan. Thank you for listening.
And when I was 12 years old, my daddy took me to the circus. The greatest show on earth. There were clowns and elephants and dancing bears, and a beautiful lady in pink tights flew high above our heads. And as I sat there watching, I had the feeling that something was missing. I don't know what, but when it was all over, I said to myself,